end of the 18th century, the great historian Edward Gibbon wrote that history is little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. Now, in many ways, that statement, which I think you agree is a particularly cheerful one about human history, looks like something of an understatement now, at the end of the 20th century, in the light of all that's gone, all the terrible, all the unspeakably appalling things that have happened during this century, the two world wars, the Holocaust, the Gulag Archipelago, the continuing cycle of horrors that grips the world at the present time. I only need to mention the name Rwanda to highlight what I mean. And therefore it's no great surprise that already at the beginning of the 20th century, James Joyce should, in his great novel Ulysses, use the character who was really standing in for him in the Rhymes of Anyone Knows. He has his character say, "History is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake." Now, I think that that's a terribly common view, a view of history which as a kind of meaningless chaos, disaster upon disaster, suffering heaped on suffering, with no clear pattern, direction, or meaning, and certainly no hope that things are likely as a result of what happens in history, as a result of what happens as societies change, develop, transform, no hope that as a result of all this things are going to get any better for human beings. I think, as I say, this is an extremely common view today. I think it's common, particularly at present time, in the aftermath of the revolutions in Eastern Europe, because the collapse of the Stalinist regimes in 1989 in Eastern Europe, followed by the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Communist Party there, what that promoted was a very widespread disillusionment with the very idea of socialism, particularly among intellectuals in the West, the group of people who had, on the whole, been associated with the idea of socialism. But at the same time as collapse of faith in the socialist ideal took place on a large scale, the very, very manifest failings of the so-called New World Order, I mean, who calls it the New World Order? Everyone calls it the New World Disorder, has undermined any triumphalist belief of a sort that briefly flourished after the East European revolutions, that somehow liberal capitalism had the answer to people's problems. So that you have, on the one hand, the disappearance of what many people thought was a socialist future, and on the other hand, the prevailing social and economic system of capitalism in all its different varieties doesn't seem to offer any real hope anyway. And in those circumstances, you do have all sorts of manifestations of pessimism. I mean, coming into Marxism this morning, I was reading an article in The Guardian by a man called Hans Magnus Enzensberger, who is a leading German intellectual and who was once upon a time associated with the left internationally. He was writing an article already explaining that nowadays you don't have as good a kind of civil war as you used to in the past. In the past, you used to kill each other for ideas like nationalism and things like that. Now, people just kill each other, but he doesn't really explain that. Some blind feeling of hatred. You know, things are deteriorating so much we even get a worse kind of civil war, worse class of civil war these days. Bring back the good old days. I'm only slightly caricaturing what he says. What he says is an expression, as I say, of a very widespread view. Now, philosophically, one highly influential expression of this view is postmodernism. Now, in the most influential, I'm not going to bore you by going on too much about postmodernism, but I just want to just give cite the most influential, perhaps, formulation of the idea of postmodernism by Jean-François Lyotard. And the reason why what he has to say is relevant is because he particularly seizes on the idea of history and the understanding of history, and he specifically attacks Marxism. He says that postmodernism represents the collapse of grand narrative. In other words, the collapse of the idea that you can make sense of the whole of human history as some relatively continuous and unified process that is a process of improvement, of emancipation, of growth in human liberation. And this idea of history as a grand narrative, he associates with two people in particular. Hegel, the great German idealist philosopher who wrote at the end of the 18th century, the time of the great French Revolution in its aftermath, and Marx, who in many ways took over Hegel's philosophy, but gave it a socialist and materialist meaning very different from Hegel's original version. And what Leotto argues is that any attempt, such as Marx's, to try and arrive at an overall understanding of history, and one that further sees history as in some way moving forward, things in some way getting better, has been refuted by the experience of the 20th century. He more or less says that after Auschwitz and after the Gulag Archipelago, you simply cannot sustain the attempt to understand history as a whole, and the idea of any sort of historical progress has simply become not simply false or meaningless, but almost obscene. Now, I really want to challenge all this. I want to defend the Marxist conception of history. And more specifically, I want to defend the idea that there's a pattern in history which involves the changes in societies representing a definite direction, a definite movement, a direction which represents an actual or potential improvement in human condition. So what I want to argue is that we can understand human history as a whole, that human history has a direction, and that that direction represents forward movement. In some sense, if we look at the pattern of human history, we can see a process of improvement going on. Now, it's important to be clear about what I'm arguing. In the first place, at the intellectual core of Marxism is a theory of history. In other words, what Marx, particularly in his great work, The German Ideology, does is to set out an explanation of how human societies develop and are transformed. And the emphasis is on transformation. That's the crucial respect, in many ways, in which Marx's theory is historical. But him understanding society is about how understanding how societies are transformed. And his theory is therefore through and through historical. He sees human societies as a succession of modes of production, of social and economic systems, feudalism, slavery, capitalism, sorry I've got them in the wrong order, but that gives you some illustrations. And the driving force that brings about the transformation of these societies, in particular the movement from one mode of production to another, from one social and economic system to another, really comes from the development of the productive forces of human beings' ability to produce and the control over nature of their physical environment for that value process. And the conflict which then develops between the forces of production, human productive powers as they develop, and the existing relations of production, the existing set of social and economic relations, crucially depending upon control of the forces of production, and class societies, the relations of exploitation that arise on the basis of those forces of control. I'm sorry, that's a very quick snapshot sketch of Marx's theory of history, but there are other meanings in Marxism that are going to develop an outline, or perhaps have already that theory of history, and it's not what I want to concentrate on. The crucial thing is to see that in Marx's theory of history, you have on the one hand something that runs continuously through human history, which is the cumulative growth of the productive forces, the development of human productive powers, more and more sophisticated forms of technology, cooperation in production, knowledge of the physical world, knowledge of the human world, that allows human beings more and more to control their physical environment, to control nature, to meet their needs more efficiently and so on. That's one strand to Marx's theory of history. The other, what you have on the other hand, is a series of systematic transformations of social relations. When the forces and relations of production come into conflict with each other, then, as Marx puts it, an epoch of social revolution opens up, in which the pressure to transform society can lead, it doesn't inevitably lead, this is something I'm going to come back to the overthrow of the existing relations. Usually through some form of revolution, through some sort of collective struggle that destroys the
old social system, and their replacement with a new set of relations to production, which permits the further development of productive forces. Okay, so a snapshot of Marx's theory of history, Marx's explanation of the dynamics of change, of the forces, the processes that lead to the transformation of society. Now, on itself, this picture of human history doesn't tell us anything about whether or not this process, the transformations involved, that Marx claims are involved in history, represents progress in the sense of an actual or potential improvement in the human condition. Just because the productive forces develop doesn't of itself, and their social revolutions itself, doesn't of itself tell you whether things are getting better, even potentially for human beings. But I'm going to argue that it's an implication of Marx's general view of history that the development of the productive forces, social revolutions, progressive replacement, one mode of production by another, do represent progress, do represent the improvements of the human being. Okay. Now, let me, that's what I'm going to concentrate in the rest of what I have to say. But let me first make it clear that to talk about historical progress, to say that there is progress in history, does not commit Marxists to any sort of crass optimism, to a vision of endless, continual progress, everything just getting better and better and better and so on and so forth. I mean, it's true, if you look at the Enlightenment, the crucial intellectual breakthrough that takes place in the 18th century, that represents the impact of capitalist development on European society, and which lays the basis, intellectually and ideologically, for the great French Revolution and all that was politically associated with, the emergence, the Enlightenment, the emergence of a group of thinkers who began systematically to dismantle the ideas, the ideology of the old feudal society, and to put in its place a much more rational and scientific view of the world, based upon the ideas of the scientific revolution in the 17th century. If you look at the Enlightenment, then it's certainly true that there's some Enlightenment philosophers who do present a picture of human history as sort of steady, continuous, unstoppable progress. They were generalising from the experience of Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries, which was on the whole an experience of cultural and economic improvement of various sorts of developments that didn't seem to represent things getting better. And some of them overextend experience to draw conclusions that are crassly optimistic. The classic case is a man called Condorcet, who wrote a book called A Sketch of the Progress of the Human Mind, in which he presents how particularly scientific developments, intellectual developments, are leading gradually to things getting better and better in society, and all forms of oppression gradually being dissolved and so on. It's always puzzled me about Condorcet that he wrote this book while he was on the run from the Jacobins during the French Revolution. Shortly after finishing it, he ended up on the guillotine. So, even in his own experience, a rather strong contrast between reality. The greatest Enlightenment philosophers weren't so naively optimistic. Voltaire, for example, his great novel Candide, which is one of the best and funniest books ever written, I think, makes fun of the idea of everything just getting better. He was a figure whom he caricatures called Dr. Pangloss, who believes that everything is for the best in this best possible world. So every horror, suffering, outrage that happens is all explained away as everything being okay. Now, I don't think that's with the sort of view, the view of Pangloss, which Voltaire lampooned so well, I think that has nothing to do with that. And in fact, I think naive optimism about progress is something that's much more characteristic of reformists than of revolutionary socialists. For example, Ramsay MacDonald, one of the key figures in the Labour Party in the early part of the 20th century, first Labour Prime Minister, for example, was a classic example of this kind of naive optimism about progress. His slogan was up and up and up, and on and on and on. You know, better. Now, that may seem like a pretty crass way of putting it, but it does reflect something about reformism if you go back to the key theoretical text of social democracy, the book by the German social democrat, Edward Bernstein, collection of articles publishing a book in the 1890s, well, the English translation is called Evolutionary Socialism. And what he does is to present a very slow, gradual, continuous process of evolution, which is going to, over time, and which is already beginning, to get rid of the obnoxious features of capitalism. And of course, the conclusion that Bernstein draws from that is that we don't need anything healthy like revolution to transform society. Now, one crucial respect in which Marxists differ from reformers, differ from social democrats, differ from people in the labour party, is precisely that revolutionary socialists and Marxists believe that history develops not simply by the good side, you know, intellectual improvements, scientific innovations, you know, better plumbing, all sorts of things like that. But I'm not running down better plumbing. It's not just that, you know, the happy, nice, obviously satisfactory things that represent historical development and progress. History develops also, and crucially develops, by what Marx called the bad side of history: exploitation, struggle, violence. Marx, back in the 1840s, attacked one of the founders of both the reformist and the anarchist traditions of socialism, Proudhon, for just emphasizing the good side. Marx said, it is the bad side that produces the movement which makes history by producing a struggle. That if you want to understand the forces that lead to historical transformation, you have to look crucially at the process of exploitation that you find in class society, how that leads to class struggle, and often terrible, violent, destructive struggles, out of which change takes place. Revolution, of necessity, is in many ways a very destructive process. It not simply leads to people being killed, to straightforward violence, but it can also lead to considerable economic destruction and destruction. Yet revolution is indispensable if social transformation is going to take place. So Marxists, even if you look at the core of Marxist politics, Marxists aren't straightforward optimists about change, because we see the way in which the historical process develops by the bad side of Marxism as well as the good side. Now this leads to a more general point, which is the Marxist conception of historical progress is dialectical. Now, this is a concept that Marx takes from Hegel, which involves essentially seeing society and seeing history as involving contradictions, as involving the constant struggle between opposing forces caught together within the same society. That's what the class struggle is about, after all. The struggle between workers and capitalists, bound together through the relationship of exploitation that defines capitalist society, but bound together in a relationship that is antagonistic, that brings them into conflict. That kind of contradiction is an illustration of the general way in which Marx sees the world. Now, what this means when it comes to the question of progress is that history for Marxists isn't a uniform, continuous process of development. Rather, it's a process in which suffering and improvement, destruction and creation, are indissolubly linked. In one of his greatest works, The Communist Manifesto, Marx brings this out very clearly. Because in the manifesto, he talks about capitalism in a way that no one else had before. There were people who celebrated capitalism as this huge social and economic breakthrough, this fantastic new system permitting people to produce much more efficiently, on a much more lavish scale than they had been able to before. And on the other hand, there were people who mourned the destruction that capitalism did, the way in which it wiped out the old feudal society, destroyed elements that you could say were good about feudal society, the way in which people were bound together in close-knit social relationships and so on and so forth. People who mourned the ecological degradation that the Industrial Revolution represented. But what Marx did was radically different from both sides, because what he does is both to celebrate capitalism as an enormous expansion in human productive powers, that kind of he hails the productive achievements that capitalism has achieved, its revolutionary capacity, the way in which it shakes up and transforms the whole of social reality throughout the world then. The famous phrase, all that is solid melts into air. That's capitalism as a revolution. But at the same time, offers an unflinching, continuous, bitter, savage condemnation of the exploitation, the degradation, the alienation that capitalism involves. The American Marxist critic, Frederick Jameson, put it very well. He said that Marx in the Manifesto asks us somehow to lift our minds to a point at which it is possible to understand that capitalism is one at the same time the best thing that has happened, ever happened to the human race, and the worst. Now, to try and bring out this dialectical view of historical progress, I want to take the case of some other writings of Marx. Writings on India that he wrote essentially as part of political journalism in the early 1850s. And I want to start by considering a particularly famous, indeed notorious article that he wrote in 1853 called The British Rule in India. Now here he's trying to sum up the overall meaning, the overall significance of, you know, one of the enormous things that happens in the 18th and 19th centuries, which is the conquest of India, one of the great civilizations of the world, by British imperialism. And in a way that brings into focus the more general question of the process through which Europe conquers and comes to dominate the whole of the rest of the world in that same period. Now in this article, Marx seems to treat British imperialism very straightforwardly as the bearer of capitalist progress, that it's by sweeping away the old form of society in India, British imperialism is laying the basis for capitalist development in India, and this Marx seems to argue is a straightforwardly progressive role. This is brought out in the conclusion to the article, where he says this: can mankind fulfill its destiny without a revolution in the social state of Asia? If not, whatever may have been the crimes of England, she was the unconscious tool of history in bringing about that revolution. So however criminal British imperialism was, it acted as the unconscious tool in installing or laying the basis for creating the conditions of the development of capitalism in India. Now, this article has been very widely attacked for many years, for all sorts of reasons. For example, that Marx was optimistic, if he was right to be, if this was something he was right to be optimistic about the possibilities of capitalist development in India under British rule, and so on. But more particularly, it's been attacked, for example, by the Palestinian writer Edward Said for treating Asia, for treating India as just a raw material, kind of raw material of the expansion of capitalism. It doesn't matter. Said claims, Marx is saying, if India suffer as a result of the British conquest of India, so long as capitalist progress takes place. Now, there are undoubtedly problems with Marx's writings on India. For example, he has a conception, which isn't relevant to the discussion here, but he has a conception of Asiatic society before the development of capitalism as static and unchanging, which I think can be shown to be mistaken. But the overall conception of capitalist development that we find in his writings is much more complex than his critics suggest. But this is very clear in a slightly later article called The Future Results of British Rule in India. And here we have absolutely no idealization of British imperialism. Marx talks about profound hypocrisy and inherent barbarism of bourgeois civilization. And he says the real face of capitalism is fully exposed in the colonies, but all the brutality, the essential nature of capitalism, all its brutality is fully exposed in the colonies without any attempt to conceal and critify its essential nature. So there's no way in which Marx is trying to deny the crimes of British imperialism. The sense in which the conquest of India represents progress is only that India's incorporation in world capitalism will permit the development of the productive powers of man, as Marx puts it. Now I'm going to come back to this idea of the productive powers of man in a minute, but Firstly, I want to read you the conclusion of the article. He says, when a great social revolution has mastered the results of the bourgeois epoch, the market of the world and the modern powers of production and subjected them to the common control of the most advanced peoples, then only will human progress cease to resemble that hideous pagan idol who would not drink the nectar but from the skulls of the slain. Now, sorry, that's just using rather ornate language of the sort that some educated as he was in the early 19th century would. But it should be clear that what Marx is saying here doesn't represent any kind of naive celebration of capitalism as straightforward historical progress. What we have here, rather, is what one could call a tragic vision of history, which progress occurs at the expense of tremendous suffering. What is it that Marx says? Human progress represents that hideous pagan idol who would not drink the nectar, but from the skulls of the slain. In other words, again, we're getting this idea that we have to try and understand, to grasp at the same time, both the terrible destruction and the very important potential creation that is involved in the movement from one mode of production, from one social and economic system to the other. In this dialectical conception of history, development isn't a straight upward line. You know, it's not like Ramsay MacDonald, on and on and on, and up, or whatever it was he said. It's a spiral movement in which progress and destruction, forward movements and suffering, hope and despair, are indissolubly linked. Now, you may well say that I've been begging one very important question up to now, which is, you know, I've been talking about progress, but surely, if we're going to defend the idea of progress, we have to have some benchmark, some way of measuring what progress is. Relative to what can we talk about progress? Now, I think the only real answer to this question is that progress consists, fundamentally, in the development of the productive forces themselves, in what Marx, in the passage I just quoted, calls the productive powers of man, the productive abilities, the productive capacities that expand and grow in the course of human history. Now this may seem like the crassest sort of vulgar Marxism, you know, that I'm just celebrating, you know, better technology and better scientific technique than that, and that sort of thing. But I don't think that's a valid response. Because essentially the productive forces aren't something that's separated from humans. This is one of the distortions that develops with the onset of capitalism, that we come to see the productive forces. The productive forces are rather the capacities, the abilities that human beings collectively have to understand the world in which they live and to know it and to control it. And as those capacities develop, then human beings' ability to make lives better for themselves in all sorts of concrete ways dramatically increases. So that no possibility of any general improvement in this condition is possible without the development of productive forces. But more, there's more than that as well. That Marx, I think, like Hegel before him, sees history as progress not just because of the growth in human productive capacities that it involves, but because of the expansion in human freedom. Marx's goal, he makes it clear, is what he calls universal human emancipation. a breaking down of all the different ways in which people are trapped and controlled and dominated by class society. You can't separate the growth of the productive forces and the social revolutions that growth is bound up with from the growth also in human freedom. Now I want to use a historical example to bring this out. I want to cite a recent book by a French historian called Guy Bois, which has been translated into English and was recently reviewed, I think rightly, very favourably, by Chris Harman in International Socialism. Now Bois's book is about what he calls the feudal revolution of the year 1000. I mean, it seems strange to think of, you know, what's generally seen as the heart of the depths of the Middle Ages, at the end of the first
millennium after Christ, there should be a revolution. But Bois argues in a very interesting way that there was. He claims that up to that time, in many ways, at least the social and political framework of the old slave societies that had been built by the Greeks and Romans survived even in countries like France. And that the crucial relationship of exploitation in those societies was still the control over slave labour by a class of slave masters. But what you find, he argues that if you trace the records, you can see a huge social, economic, and political crisis taking place towards the end of the 10th century, around the year 1000, which leads to the fall of that system. And this happens right in large areas of Europe, and its replacement by feudalism. In other words, by a social system in which production is now carried on by peasants who are subject to the political power and who are exploited by caste laws, but who, unlike slaves, have a degree of real control over themselves and over their own process of production. They're far less directly dominated and systematically controlled by their exploiters than slaves are. So that this feudal revolution, as Bois calls it, represents a real liberation for the peasants. And it was only possible because of previous development of the productive forces, in particular the gradual replacement of larger states worked by slave labour, very characteristic of the slave system at its height under the Roman Empire, by small-scale peasant production. The small-scale peasant production involved real technical innovation that hadn't been made up of the slave society, because the full slave society, because the slave masters hadn't had an interest in doing it, because they had access to so much slave labour. But with the slow development of peasant production, the direct producers, people who up to now had been slaves, begin to wrest real control over the basic production of food and so on, which everything rested in, and therefore over their own mind. They are able, for example, to set up their own households, living with their families, rather than being in huge barracks in which men and women are kept separate from each other, and so on and so forth. And it's this growing control over production by the slaves which made possible the overthrow of the old slave economic system. So as Bois puts it, the feudal revolution inaugurated the true age of the peasantry. Like other revolutions, it certainly had an oppressive aspect, but it was first of all liberating. So there we have once again the two phases of progress. On the one hand, liberation, a degree of liberation, but at the same time the consolidation of a new form of exploitation. The slaves turn peasants, get rid of their old slave masters, but they still have the feudal lord about them, who continues to exploit them, even if they have more control over them. Their lives. And the same is, of course, true with the revolutions that got rid of feudalism and introduced the dominance of capitalism in countries like England and France and so on. An oppressive system is overthrown, but a new system of exploitation is set in its place. And as Marx says in that passage that I read earlier, it's only when you get a socialist revolution that destroys capitalism as the last form of class society that progress ceases to have this combination of destruction and creation, of suffering and liberation, that I try to bring out. Now, this leads me then to one final point. To a large extent, the growth of the productive forces is only potentially liberating. This is what Marx says in the same article on India that I quoted earlier. The Indians will not reap the fruits of the new elements of society, scattered among them by the British people, till in Great Britain itself, the now ruling classes will have been supplanted by the industrial proletarians, or till the Hindus themselves have grown strong enough to throw off the new yoke altogether. So there's nothing automatic about the development of capitalism in India benefiting the masses of Indians. For them to be benefited, there has either to be socialist revolution in the developed capitalist countries that produce imperialism in the first place, or there has to be revolution in the colonially oppressed countries like India itself. Best of all, actually, is a combination of the two, a genuinely global revolution, in which the workers
the and peasants of the oppressed of the world rise up against their exploiters and overthrow them. Now, why is this so important? It means that progress can't be separated from revolution. We can only fully benefit from the effects of the development of the productive forces under capitalism. Realise their fruits as Marx puts it, by overthrowing capitalism. Now this then brings me back to something that I touched on earlier, which is that there's nothing inevitable about revolution. A great social and economic crisis opens up a deep point of social revolution. It puts the question of revolution onto the agenda, but it doesn't make the success of revolution inevitable. Elsewhere, Marx puts it very well. He says, every great period of time struggle leads either to a social revolution, which replaces the existing social system by a more progressive one, or it leads to the common ruination of the contending classes. More concretely still, as Rosa Luxemburg put it, in the case of capitalism, the choice is between socialism or barbarism. And there's nothing to say, there's no way of objectively guaranteeing that socialism rather than barbarism is going to be the option that wins out. Now, what this means is that there's nothing, therefore, also inevitable about the forward movement of history. The failure to make revolution in a particular conjuncture, a particular time of acute crisis, can lead actually to nurture back into barbarism. The great case, the terrible case in the present century, is of course that of Germany between the walls. Because the wedge between 1918 and 1923, the question of the working class taking power, was on the agenda, a successful socialist revolution didn't take place, then the conditions were created in which the most barbarous conceivable, imaginable counter-revolution could take place in the shape of Hitler's Nazis. Dan Guérin, French socialist writer, put it very well in the 30s. He said that fascism will be our punishment for letting the hour of socialism pass. In other words, to say that there is progress in history is not to say that we can sit back and wait, comfortably for things to get better and better. That's the reformist delusion. The reformist delusion is that there's something automatic about history moving forward. For the revolutionary, whether or not progress takes place, or whether or not we do slide back, are driven back into a new dark age, depends above all on human action, on collective human action, on above all the great struggles of workers, the great struggles of the working class, resisting their exploiters, moving against their exploiters, but also, crucially, within those struggles, the development of socialist organisation, which sets as its conscious goal socialist revolution. In other words, which sets the most important single act of liberation in the history of the human species on the agenda. It's finally up to human beings to make history and to determine whether or not progress takes place.